Hi, everyone. Welcome. Very glad you could all make it today. My name is Ben Grossman. Happy to be hosting a fantastic panel, which should be an exciting discussion. Before we get started, I always think in a conference like this, it's good if throughout there's kind of storylines and people ask the same questions. So Prince Ali didn't take the bait when we started, but would any of you like to declare your candidacy for president of FIFA? No. All right, we'll keep going then. We'd love to go down the line and just have you introduce yourself, a bit about your company and all.
Sure. I'm Gareth Capon. I run a business called Gravio that's here in the UK. We're a real-time social video business, which means we work with lots of broadcasters and rights holders, helping them to distribute and to monetize their social video assets. So it means getting content out on the social platforms, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and others in real time in a matter of seconds, whether it's from broadcasts, whether it's taking archive assets and redistributing those, whether it's creating mobile videos, but being able to engage and understand and take advantage of the sort of the sponsorship and monetization and engagement opportunities that comes with that. So the focus of our business is about the way that conversation is ultimately driving consumption through social platforms and predominantly through mobile devices, and that's the focus of where we sit in the ecosystem.
Thanks, Peter.
I'm Peter Hutton, CEO of Eurosport, and most importantly, one of Gareth's customers. Eurosport, I think, is a brand that most people around here will know, in that it's been really a dominant factor in pay TV since almost the start of pay TV in Europe. So a sort of 25-year history in most markets. But it's changed pretty dramatically in the last year, where Discovery have come in, bought the whole company, really invested in content, and turned it far more into a local brand, where we're making content dedicated to various markets, from the UK to France to Poland to every market in Scandinavia. So we're trying to turn a pan-European brand into a far more locally important brand, and also invest heavily in terms of our digital footprint, where Eurosport.com is the biggest sports website in Europe, and we've got a very successful business in terms of our player, where we offer content direct to consumer on OTT, as well as the very strong social media channels on Twitter and Facebook.
Ken?
Good afternoon. My name's Ken Mynardis. I'm Vice President of Sport at Getty Images. Getty Images is the world's largest provider of photography. We essentially run two businesses, an editorial photography business, which would be very familiar to many people, supplying the world's broadcasters, newspapers, magazines, websites, onlines, with the best sports photography we possibly can. At the same time, we're also supplying some of the world's largest sports clubs, leagues, governing bodies, and their partners and licensees with solutions and content to help them activate their brands and their own content strategies.
I'm Andy McKenzie. I'm one of the co-founders of Livewire Sports. We're a digital agency who provide a range of content services for rights holders, particularly federations, but also brands and broadcasters. So we were sort of born out of the BBC moving the sports department up to Manchester, set up in 2011, and we work for the likes of the Premier League, for Wimbledon, for International Tennis Federation, for Ascot, and most recently NFL International. Partly helping them with their digital strategy, but also managing their social channels, their digital channels, and creating content.
Great, thanks. Happy to have you all here, of course. So the conversation today is about the quickly changing world of media, dealing with consumers, what they want, how to meet in the middle there, and how to, oh, by the way, build a business around that at the same time. Luckily, we're here to solve that in the next 41 minutes, so off we go. So let's define what this world is right now, what this media world is, which has changed so much in the last, well, what time is it? So let's take in the last, year or two or whatever. I'd like to hear from your perspectives, what are the big changes that are really happening recently that are actually affecting your business and making you react on a day-to-day basis, if you'd like to start?
Sure. I mean, as a social video business, I suppose even the term social video is relatively new. You know, you go back 3 or 4 years, and there was one social video business, and that was YouTube. You know, it was the world's biggest video platform. You know, continues to be that, but it didn't really have any competition in the space. And what was changing through that period is obviously the growth of other social platforms, predominantly driven by conversations. It was text and it was images, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, WhatsApp, the messaging platforms in Asia, etc. And what's come in the last, you know, effectively only 18 months to 2 years, and really most of that growth is in the last 18 months, is video has come to those platforms. And what's changed for us as a, you know, as a provider of sort of platform services into that market is that we're seeing an enormous shift in the way that people consume video, both in the devices that they choose, but also the platforms in which that video is consumed. You know, Facebook's video product is only 18 months old. They're delivering 4 billion video views a day now. Snapchat is the same in just a few months. You're talking about, you know, an environment where sort of new consumption platforms have emerged in a period which is less than 2 years, which is, you know, it's a tiny amount of time in the grand scheme of sort of television, where you're now actually having an opportunity to take video products to billions of people around the world. And that's entirely changed the landscape about the way that rights holders have an opportunity to think both about their customers, but also about the consumption patterns of that audience.
Okay, so they're consuming them in different places now. There's more and more places pretty consistently. Are they also consuming them? Are there different things that are working? Shorter video, longer video, high quality usage? I mean, where are we going trend-wise there right now?
Absolutely. I think it's probably all of the, obviously one, the trend has definitely been towards shorter form. If you're talking about mobile, you know, the sweet spot for video on the platforms that we tend to support is about 30 to 60 seconds for most people. The reason is quite clear. It's because most of our customers are discovering the videos on social platforms. It's in a feed. It's in an environment where most of that attention is quite short, and therefore it's consumption which is found, you know, discovered, enjoyed, and then shared. And sharing is a key part of this process. Obviously, what drives the viral distribution of content on these platforms is actually putting out content which is of real interest to people, and therefore they're willing to share it with other people, with their friends and other people that follow them. In terms of the types of content, I think you're right. I think also the scope of what social video represents creates new opportunities for partners. Wimbledon's one of our clients. We work with them through 2014 and again this year. They, two interesting things you sort of take from that experience over that 12-month period. One is they grew social video distribution 15 times in a year. So we're not talking about something which is growing, you know, a few percent per annum. We're talking about, you know, massive amounts of growth on the same platforms to effectively similar audiences. But also the types of content that they shared wasn't necessarily the same content which would have had huge amounts of value from a broadcast perspective. So, you know, Wimbledon has very important broadcast partners, and that's a key part of the distribution mix and obviously a core part of their revenue. So the focus of the social video campaign was about, you know, about engagement, whether that was walk-ons and walk-offs or funny moments in the crowd or stuff happening behind the scenes or, you know, other bits of the story that you didn't necessarily get told from a broadcast perspective. The two most popular clips, one was Roger Federer's trick shot hitting a lob between his legs in the second round, again, not necessarily a big broadcast game, and the other was David Beckham catching a ball in the crowd in the Royal Box in the fourth round, which did over 8 million views on Facebook. Now, when you look at that, you know, that 15-second moment isn't clearly going to drive your discussion with a broadcaster for your next round of licenses. But as a moment in time, a moment that drove conversation on social platforms, this nature of sort of ephemeral content, it had a huge amount of value for the tournament and driving engagement with that audience and potentially new audiences too. And I think that understanding of demographic is really important when you think about reaching the broad spectrum of your audience from, you know, from 85 to 15 or even 5 in the future. Yeah. You have to think about it, more platforms than just television.
Okay. Peter, you run a business from which he clips. What are the big changes for you?
I think it's a pretty similar experience in that, you know, we have to scream for attention, because if people aren't aware of what you're offering and how you're changing your product, you're really doing nothing of value. And what I love about the short-form content that's pushed on Twitter, on Facebook, is it's driving people to watch a better story on Eurosport. In the old days, Eurosport used to offer essentially one feed, one video linear service to the whole of Europe. And that's a model that clearly doesn't work anymore. You know, we have to be far more local, far more relevant. We have to offer stories that allow people to immerse themselves in the experience. But above all, we have to make sure that people know that we're there, because it's easy to forget about an old brand. And therefore, to be using platforms such as Grabio or other media to say, look, there's a great game happening now, and you can watch it in these different ways on these different platforms, becomes key to us developing and building up the audience figures. You know, we've had an amazing year in the UK. You know, our audiences are up over 20%, but our content really hasn't changed. Now, what has really changed is that we're producing more around what we do, and we're using other media to try and drive people to us. You know, you need to have content on free-to-air, you need to have short-form clips, and thankfully, as part of Discovery Group, we're able to do that as a story, and I think that's what's really driven our audience figures over the last year.
Okay.
think in the sports photography world, there's sort of two really good examples that are worth looking at. One in the kind of competitive landscape and one in a kind of content landscape. From a competitive standpoint, a kind of enormous explosion in the use of photography around sports and football particularly in the last few years and, you know, exponentially growing day by day has meant we're seeing certainly the entry of competition that we haven't seen before into a space that has traditionally been dominated by large organizations like Getty Images. I think what you see there is, you know, software companies, technology platforms, all becoming, seeing the value in engaging in the sports photography world. We address that by continuing to underline what makes us special, what we believe makes us special, our quality, the strength of our relationships, and the service we offer. On the content side, there's something really interesting, I think, happening in photography, which is, I think, apparent to everybody, but not necessarily that it's so particular to photography. Throughout the history of photography, we've seen a kind of development from a single image. Sports photography was always about capturing a moment and dwelling over that moment and saying that you had it forever. The birth of digital allowed photographers for the first time to tell stories, to tell narrative, to construct narrative through long sequences of images. And now we're seeing through the, you know, the fascinating development around interactivity, the return back to essentially a single moment, but readers and consumers wanting to explore that moment in much more depth than they ever did before. And so, you know, we've got interesting things going on with, obviously the key moment this year we feel was the part of the Oculus and Facebook deal, which we're now working closely with Oculus on content for their new thing, because that's for the first time, I think, brings interactivity to scale, which is going to be key. Okay. In the coming months.
Good.
But I know you want us to disagree, but I'm certainly going to have to agree with kind of in terms of the video side of it. You know, that kind of real time short clips. You know, in the past year, that's, you know, if you're not creating video on Facebook, then you need a lot of money to get your content right to the top algorithm. So for a lot of the people that we work for, it's finding how do we create video and whether that's being able to use their own rights that they have. A lot of our clients don't have that. So creating video around the live event, so whether that's behind the scenes, whether that's before, after, you know, kind of Wimbledon's is a good example. Essentially their rights are restricted in terms of what they can, you know, Roger Federer's log, but, you know, what they can do outside of what happens on the court. And certainly on social, that quick hit, rough, ready, works really well. As opposed to kind of the 3 minutes, 4 minutes polished highlights video that I think people were producing a year ago and, you know, wait until Saturday night to watch the highlights of the football, I think doesn't work anymore. It needs to be, you know, immediacy is what people want because they'll get it elsewhere otherwise.
And I think also from a broadcaster's point of view, it allows you a much better relationship with the federation. You know, if you can be seen to be creating something that is unique, that goes viral, that helps bring new people to them, you know, that means you improve your relationship with them. So there's a long-term business advantage as well as getting short-term value as well.
Okay. So it sounds like you're talking about a marketing challenge as much as anything, right? At the end of the day, it's driving people back to a core product that you're, it sounds like that's the value.
Well, I think a lot of it's about competition for time. I mean, we talk about, like, in a world where, you know, in the past, in a world where media was much more restricted, then the opportunity really was the marketing channel to reach the specific users that you felt as a media organization that you could then own. In a world where many of your consumers obviously spend time on platforms which are, you know, ultimately discovery platforms, and you're competing for their time and their attention, and therefore that ability to create content experiences that resonate with them means that you have a chance to compete for time. And whether that's, you know, if it's a football club for building, you know, audience and engagement and selling tickets or merchandise or OTT subscriptions, whether it's a broadcaster bringing subscribers or audience, in the end, there is still 24 hours in the day, and therefore we're competing for the time of each consumer. I just think the amount of competition for that time in terms of media has increased.
Okay.
And I think, you know, our challenge is to try and keep it within one umbrella. You know, if we're selling advertising time on TV around a product, you know that people are going to go away to a second screen, they're going to be doing other things while they're watching a live game. So you need to be offering them that option that is permanently dragging them back to the live, but keeps them in your environment so you can sell that experience to your advertisers.
Okay. So these are all the changes that have happened. Is there anything that's right around the corner that you're keeping an eye on? Anything starting to bubble up yet that you're watching that maybe we may have to react to in the next 6 months or year? Anybody see the future real quick?
Well, they've already mentioned Oculus, which is obviously the next, you know, the next big interesting in terms of sort of immersive engagement experience. And obviously virtual reality and augmented reality is interesting. My personal view, it's still some way from being mainstream out of the game sector, where it's obviously there's a very considered environment. But I think that idea that people can start to have different types of immersive experiences from a video perspective, I think is really interesting. I don't necessarily believe that you'll be able to replicate a great live sports experience in that environment anytime soon. I think we're some way technically away from that. But I certainly would expect that there will be people looking to take opportunities to build in the same way as you sort of look at the genesis of the music industry, where you go through this process. We were actually talking about this earlier. The music industry went through this process where the internet sort of seemed to destroy a lot of value in that industry for a period of time, but actually the live experiences have actually become more important to the industry now and are creating more value over time. And obviously how you add intensity around that live experience may well be where the focus is over.
Peter, are you guys testing VR in live events?
We are. We did it at US Tennis last week, and the reaction is unbelievable. You know, and I think we'd love to see what happens with winter sports as well. You know, when you're in a captive environment, if you're in a bobsleigh, for example, to try and turn that into a virtual reality experience is not just a way of creating good TV, but it's also a way of people genuinely emotionally engaging with the sport better. You know, and as Gareth said, the word immersive is key. You know, if you can get people to watch a sports event in the same way as they watch a movie, where you go out and you found suddenly it's raining and it's dark and you came in the light, you know, if you can do that, that's the golden ticket in terms of a sports viewing experience. And maybe VR is part of that story.
A couple of years ago, you couldn't go into a television store in America without massive signs everywhere, 3D TV, 3D TV, next thing. Not this all over again?
Yeah, I mean, again, some things work, some things don't work, right? No, but you have to test them.
I was going to say, it's perhaps possibly a mistake trying to predict where this is going. And actually, it's about the journey, because it's not that long ago that we were doing exactly the same thing. We were learning about how to take 3D stills again, yeah. You know, which was really interesting. Clearly, 3D didn't take off. But what it did was teach us lots of things, really valuable lessons about the way people interacted with the pictures, with the way you needed to shoot in a whole new different way. And then, you know, right from that to kind of very basic interactive 360s and that kind of thing, and now to, you know, much more sophisticated video VR and 360 and gigapixel VR and all the rest, it's kind of taking us iteratively, I think, to where we're going. And rather than predict it, I think it's actually the journey that will define.
One thing I'd be interested to get your perspective on would be the sort of the competition from the other side. I suppose, you know, and you would know it well, this sort of brilliant chart of the sales of cameras through the phone revolution. Obviously they shot up through the early 2000s and completely dropped off. But actually, when you look at the sales of cameras overall, it's now billions of devices because they're in every smartphone on the planet. And are you seeing competition from, you know, a football player inside the dressing room taking a selfie and pushing that out to a social audience, which is obviously quite a different image experience than Getty, for example?
We would see that as an opportunity, especially if we could partner with a club, a federation, or a player around that. That is... I think that is exactly where we can really add value as a distribution platform. I think ultimately, you know, the event itself is so well covered by your 32 cameras, 150 photographers around the field, that actually what we're trying to also bring to market is that kind of premium experience that is only brought to you by a player with his, possibly with the phone, but also by a club photographer in parts of the club that they might not.
So by premium, you mean premium access, not necessarily premium quality?
I think the two things can be the same thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, let's talk about that. What else makes content premium right now? Anybody can shoot a picture. Anybody can take video now. It's pretty simple, and our kids are growing up that way, right? Where they don't necessarily, they're not brought up that you have to watch something on television or in a cinema first.
From our perspective, you still need to catch the moment. Yeah. At the end of the day, you need to still do the bread and butter. But then after that, you start building blocks that actually start to differentiate the content and make it truly, truly premium. From a photography perspective, when we're competing against everybody watching a game on, you know, through the eyes of 32 cameras and whatever else they're watching on social media, we have to, what we always call the wow factor. We want people to look at a photograph, the next, you know, whether it's on their second screen, whether it's in their newspaper, whether it's the next day, and go, you know what, I didn't see this on the television.
Okay.
And that really comes through the skill and the experience and the quality of your photographers. The exclusivity piece is absolutely key as well, whether you're partnering with the right people to be able to get that exclusivity. I think also collapsing your speed to market now is an absolute key element of quality and defining what quality is. Quality is a very glib statement, but actually all these things go to make.
What do you mean? What do you mean by collapsing speed of market? I can hit a button right now, take a picture of you, and tweet it out.
I mean that to be able to get a defining moment from a sports event, from the moment the ball hits the back of the net to all your viewers, subscribers, customers around the world in 180 seconds, and then continue to collapse that, so that you are able to really make that as live an experience as possible.
Okay.
I think that drive to quality is a theme for all of us, really, and that as you have increasing amount of clutter, that it's the quality that will, put you above everybody else, and it's more and more difficult to get there. And you look at what we're doing as a business, whereas before we used to shout out about we're showing 10,000 hours of live content or whatever it is, now it's far more about we've got this major experience like the US Open, we're putting out 10 feeds simultaneously, we're making more of the quality, as opposed to dealing with a bulk product.
I think your point about access is really important, though, too. I think people are looking for a greater range of storytelling around the things that they're interested in, whether that's a sporting event or a music event, whatever it may be, because there is, social platforms definitely allow greater storytelling to happen. They allow more storytelling to happen in real time, but also other people will tell that story. The old days when we had to keep a press story inside the club, we know that's disappeared now because things will break, and they'll break through social platforms, and the players have their own channels and the clubs have the channels, and it's very, very difficult to keep things contained, which means the reverse is also true. Consumers are, certainly from a football perspective, they're increasingly global. They may well not be going to the games or having the same access on television, but they want to hear the story of the clubs and the players, and that means they want the inside story, and they want to be able to get much more than they would have got, 10 or 15 years ago as a football fan.
Okay, so it's not just kicking out stuff, it's curation, it's building it into a storyline. Are you buying any of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, user-generated content, we've been talking about it for 10 years now. People are everywhere, everyone can be a broadcaster, everyone that has an iPhone or a smartphone can create content. So finding that the best content and surfacing it in front of people is kind of part of what we need to do. But people will see that as a threat, whether that's a cameraman or a photographer or a journalist or anyone. All you see is an opportunity. You go to a football match and you've got 50,000 potential people telling different stories. For the likes of the Premier League, that's got to be a good thing. You've got 50,000 people telling your story, promoting your game. So, how do you use that for your benefit?
And the approach to the platforms, I think, is fascinating. You've got, the sort of Facebook and to an extent Twitter approach, where it's about the algorithm, it's about the understanding of user behavior, which is curating that story. And then you've got somebody like Snapchat, which is totally the opposite, where they're taking in millions of pieces of content from consumers, and they're actually curating a story for their audience. And I think that both have a place, and I'm interested in how that market develops, because they're quite different approaches to the same, ultimately the same sort of consumer space.
So you guys are talking about access, showing behind the scenes, how much all that stuff, showing what's not on television and all that. If I'm the manager of a football club, right, the last thing I want is you four in my locker room with your cameras taking pictures to send out to your customers, because I don't care about your customers. How are you running into people like that, or is the access starting to come more and more? Is it just part of the doing business if you're a football club, if you're a league or whatever? Are they becoming more open?
Look, I think some people are clearly scared of this, right? And it loses the control that maybe a club or a league had. But the reality is that if you've got a footballer tweeting genuinely what he feels and what he's doing on a day-to-day basis, as a fan, that makes me feel far more close to the story. And I think one of the dangers that football went through was it all felt a bit too artificial, and you're only getting the 30-second meaningless sound bites. Mm-hmm. And what I love about Twitter is that you actually see a footballer saying something that he cares about, and the fact that he's a real person and he watches certain TV programs. And that sense of personality really does give you a more in-depth experience of watching the sport.
Okay. If you go back 30 or 40 years, these types of stories still came out of football clubs, but through personal relationships between players and journalists on training fields. Mm-hmm. The player would leave a training field, he'd have a great relationship with a journalist, and they'd have a quick chat, there'd be a story, and it would be something that you wouldn't necessarily read about either from a game or a press. What we're now seeing is that this is just being taken under the control of the clubs, and actually they're very willing to be, as long as they maintain control, and own the content in some circumstances, and find the right distribution partner and a trusted partner, then actually it's extremely constructive for them to then take that out to the Asian market, to the North American market, to wherever they want it to go.
I think a lot of football clubs still have that issue where the manager is controlling everything and doesn't see the benefits of the player in the dressing room tweeting, sending out his messages, because you know they're not like us. They're not in their mid-20s. They're maybe in their 40s, 50s, and you know they see social media as this new thing that they're a little bit scared of. But that's got to change, because the world is changing, and if they don't change, then they're going to get left behind. Okay. Great opportunity for smaller clubs, I think, you know, to grow, particularly overseas, you know, to get ahead of maybe some of the bigger clubs. I think a lot of them, certainly in the last couple of years, have invested a lot and have seen the opportunities, particularly kind of to reach audiences in Asia and Africa and South America through social media.
Yeah. I think we see also that the players can be really interesting distribution channels of their own right. You know, we have some players as investors, which is quite unusual as a startup. But one of the reasons that was really interesting to us, because we believe in this idea of talent as a channel, these ideas that people of influence on social platforms can start to drive distribution and consumption behaviours. And we've seen it both, you know, within sport, you know, it's Cesc Fabregas talking about Chelsea, but we've also seen it, you know, across sports too. You know, Thierry Henry is one of our investors. He's also a big tennis fan and friends of Roger Federer, so he loves sharing tennis content from that includes Roger in it. You know, ATP Media is one of our clients, and some of the great stuff that Federer will do on the court, Thierry will share with his audience. And it's him saying, I'm a tennis fan, I'm genuinely interested in tennis, and I want to share this content with my audience. And he'll generate huge spikes in engagement and viewing and consumption and sharing with a totally different audience that the ATP would reach on a social platform. And that's really interesting when you think about what that represents for, you know, for content owners, for rights holders, for broadcasters, even for clubs. You've actually got this ecosystem of access to potentially hundreds of millions of people if it's controlled in the right way.
Okay, sounds like a great marketing tool. Is Cesc making any money off that?
Right now? Yeah. No, I mean, but I think that's the point. I think there are two opportunities here for the players. There's one is telling your story of who you are as an individual. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so if it's Thierry Henry and he's saying, I'm a tennis fan, he wants to share tennis content. But I certainly do believe that over time, the syndication models of the first generation of the internet, which is about people putting content on other people's websites or other people's platforms, will in the future with social media, the players will also be seen as channels in that way. And they will start to, you know, whether it's the player or the club or someone of influence, will start to reap the benefits of that distribution.
Okay. I'd be surprised if the data that they were generating from that kind of thing wasn't then being very useful in driving new endorsement packages and new licenses and new partners.
Yeah.
And certainly if not now, it will do in the future. Yeah. As they're able to data mine, you know, all that data from those kind of channels.
I'd subscribe to the Zlatan Ibrahimovic channel tomorrow, so I think there probably is something there. Hang on a sec, guys, I'm just gonna do something real quick. 1, 2, 3, 4, right. Okay, I am now live broadcasting. Took 4 touches. Literally, 4 touches. I'll put that away in case somebody says something. Does that scare you, Peter? 4
no,
touches and I'm a live broadcaster. You're going to be working at Starbucks next year?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, Meerkat, we worked with at the US Open, where we went into this grassy area that's right just behind Center Court and the US Open,
yeah,
and went live for like 4 minutes, just going around showing the people and what they were doing. And the amount of concurrent streams was supposedly, and I'm always a bit wary of stats, about the same as you get for a U2 concert live. I mean, it was unbelievable. You know, went viral immediately, and people couldn't believe the access that we were getting. You know, and I think anything that opens doors in that way and demystifies sport a little bit and drags people into a new experience has got to be a positive thing. You know, filming things with a mobile phone might be something we'll try and clamp down within stadiums occasionally, but it's never going to replicate the TV viewing experience of the 32 cameras. And hopefully it can take people up a stepping stone from saying, OK, I'm interested in that game, now let me go and watch the proper broadcast. And one of the real challenges for our industry is how do you take people up those stepping stones? You know, the danger of being the USPGA Tour only visible on expensive pay channels around the world is the perfect model for sports federations to say, I don't want to be like that. You know, I need to touch people on multiple streams, on free-to-air, on basic pay, on premium pay. And that's why the sort of the whole Discovery Eurosport model is constructed like that. where we say, look, let's find a way of bringing people in by using a Grabio or different technology and take them up that platform and make them more committed, emotional, paying subscribers.
Can I just, you're a pay TV service, you've got a pay TV service, and can I just stick my phone, flip on Periscope or Meerkat, put it in front of my television, and now I have your 32 cameras working for me? That's not a concern at all.
Look, it is a concern. Yeah. I mean, you know, we'll see where this goes, but I think the reality is it exists, right? So you have to create something that's better than that experience. And that's the reality of everything that we've learned from broadband coverage of sport. You know, you saw all the illegal feeds of Premier League games everywhere. You know, the reality of having to combat that, and broadcasters have done it around the world, is you make all those feeds available for a fee in a place which is secure and a quality environment. You can't say, let's play that game of banging them all on the heads. You have to provide a better service in a environment that gives people a positive experience.
Okay. No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think we essentially have to listen to consumers. We can't tell consumers what they need to do. And ultimately, this is the market talking to us. We also have to see that as our motivation to constantly raise quality and constantly raise the bar. Okay. You know, I think it's an extremely healthy thing.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned, and we've got about 14 minutes left. I want to leave some time if there's some questions here, so we'll get to everybody in a minute. You mentioned globalization versus localization and the whole idea of the long tail and everything. Andy, let's start with you. How much are you focused on localizing everything? Is that where we're headed, that everybody's just niches and targeted is what's working now because the technology allows us to do that?
I think that's where everyone needs to get to. I think we work for 15 clients, probably maybe 10 of them are based in the UK, but probably less than half see the UK as the focus. So they're looking at global, they're looking at, you know, we did some work for the Caribbean Premier League recently. A lot of that was done from our office in London. Okay. We obviously sent a team out to the Caribbean to cover that, but actually their biggest opportunity is in India and Pakistan, because there's only so much they can grow in the Caribbean. The stadiums are full, same with Wimbledon. Wimbledon doesn't have to advertise tickets. There's people queuing up for 2 days to get in. Their big opportunity is to grow their brand toward, you know, a younger audience, but an overseas audience. And the Caribbean Premier League, of their Facebook page, probably 45-50% is in India and Pakistan. And all the content that they produce is in English language. Premier League has, they have five key markets outside of the UK that we push content to, and it's understanding a lot more, because those audiences don't just speak a different language, but they want different content. They want content that's relevant to them. They don't want to just translate what we're producing for a UK audience. Yeah. They want it needs to be relevant to them. So yeah. That creates, again, more opportunities, but also more challenges to find people that know that market, that can speak their languages, that can create content that's relevant.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got a perfect example of that coming up with this Olympics deal, where, yeah, you know, we buy the rights in 51 countries, and basically there's 51 different headline stories in each country. Yeah. You know, last Olympics, the London Olympics, I was working in Asia, and we had huge backlash on social media because we were in Singapore, and a Singaporean won a bronze medal in an event, and that was like a massive element of national pride. And we didn't really do it justice in Singapore. So, you know, one of our challenges with the Olympics is, how do you make that incredibly locally relevant in all your markets while still keeping the economy of scale that makes the purchase of those rights valuable?
So what's the answer? What are you going to do?
I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Fair enough. Are you guys targeting geographically at all, or is it just different niches, or how are you guys handling that?
It's both. So some of the, clearly much of what we do is driven by rights. So mm-hmm. Depending whether it's, you know, you work with the broadcaster or rights holder, and many of those rights obviously still exist, you know, territorially. So you need to make sure that you distribute the content where the rights exist, and therefore, you know, to make sure that you work within those rights regulations. In terms of targeting, then that gives you two opportunities. You've obviously got targeting on a geographic or a platform basis, which is ultimately related to rights, and then you've got targeting on a demographic basis. So if you're putting, you know, a sponsorship campaign or paid media support behind some of the content, then you can get quite specific about what audience you then go after to help drive that distribution. We ran a campaign recently with one of the music labels where we were helping to launch a new band. And one of the really interesting things was that we took some content from a live event, a gig, and we pushed a small segment of a song, so 60 seconds out to their audience across all their social platforms. And then we targeted you know, the fans of that band on Facebook and on Twitter, but also some of the fans of some similar bands, and saw an absolutely massive uptake in the distribution of the video, the content, and the reach that we got. And we sort of did, you know, a single piece of content that did 5 times the views of their entire audience on Facebook with a small amount of marketing money, and then obviously that distribution in real time. And what that shows you is that if you can find the people that are interested in the content, then in the social environment, that content will then travel. And that's the bit that's really interesting. You'll benefit from the viral distribution of the content, but you need to get that content in front of the right individual.
Well, tell us the name of the band so we can sound cool with our kids later, please.
The band was called Years and Years.
Okay, good. Years and Years, everyone. Sound cool tonight. Great. We do have some time for a couple questions. Otherwise, I've got some more. Does anybody have any questions in the room? Happy to take one or two. A very inquisitive bunch we've got. Very nice. Well, a couple more things I've got I want to talk about. We talked about what you saw coming and what's changing now and everything that way. Threat-wise, though, what are you worried about? I mean, what are the concerns you have right now that you've got to be defending against as you go forward with all this? Is there anything that really does stick out that could threaten you now?
I think the hardest part is growing as a business and potentially the skills gap that there is, particularly for the next generation coming up. I guess we have a team of maybe 25, 30 people, most of whom have a kind of journalistic editorial background, whether that's kind of video, whether that's creating text content, whether that's visual. But finding people that know social media, they know sports, they understand storytelling, I think is hard to get people. I can't throw anyone in to run the Premier League Twitter account on a Saturday. Yeah. So essentially, where the next generation coming through, you know, we've monitored and spoke to a lot of journalistic colleges who are training, and the training is still the same training that I had back in the 90s, without giving my age away.
That explains a lot about the journalism profession.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. You know, they're still teaching people how to get jobs in newspapers. You know, I'm not sure if that's the same outside of the UK, but certainly from what we've seen in the UK. So where the 20-year-olds coming through that really can come straight into our industry, and, you know, there are some. The people that work for us are getting younger. We're bringing people in. A lot of them are very talented. They're teaching us a lot of things. But there's not a huge talent pool, I think, to aim for.
Okay.
I would say that as traditionally as the biggest player in our part of the ocean, we're always incredibly wary and careful around complacency and being disrupted by others entering where we are at the moment. I mean, I think we actively now try and disrupt ourselves. As we did last year when we launched the non-commercial embed free service for 80 million images, which kind of made everybody sit up and go, hang on a minute, how are you going to do that? But it's actually, again, it's a part of this iterative journey that, you know, as you disrupt yourself, you start to point yourself in the right direction and start to build a consumer business from a B2B business. So it's that kind of, to disrupt yourself, I think, is incredibly key at the moment, no matter how well you think you're doing. Okay. It's actually challenge everything. Constantly.
That's funny. That's exactly the answer I was going to give. You know, it's complacency. You know, you said to us, you're a pay TV broadcaster. You know, that's the last thing I want people who work for Eurosport to think that we are. You know, we're someone who provides content to people in multiple ways. And some of that is free to air. Some of that is on digital media. You know, we're not just a pay TV broadcaster anymore. We have to find a way of taking the events that we've been given the honor of representing and using that content in multiple ways to make the experience for any fan a more engaging experience, and not just thinking we're about one linear 24/7 TV feed.
Give me a practical example of how you do that. We all run businesses, or we're a part of businesses. I mean, do you get together once a month and say, how would we put ourselves out of business? Is there anything practical you're actually doing in your day-to-day lives
Yes.
that are doing this?
So for us, you know, we've just started a thing in the last week where we say, okay, let's look at our 12 big events of the year and have a meeting 4 months before each of those events and let's get everybody looking at it from every different perspective, from the social media people, from the promos guys, from the marketing guys, say, you know, do we sub-license that content? How do we grow that brand? How do we create a franchise management, if you like, around our key content and do more and more with those key federations that are linked to our future? Because if we can come up with lots of original ideas that helps them engage with more people long term, then they'll be more willing to trust us with their content.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we have a process which runs through sort of the middle of the year every year where, yes, we're building for the future through kind of typical, you know, small step growth. But at the same time, there's part of that process which challenges everybody to come up with genuinely strategic and disruptive big ideas. Many of them never see the light of day, but some of them emerge towards the end of the year and into the next year, and that's exactly how some of those things have come to light.
Okay. For those of you that work directly in social media, I'm interested to get from your perspective, because you're so wrapped up in it, what are the trends of the different social media companies right now? Twitter seems to own immediacy, but can't grow. Facebook has massive scale, but doesn't have immediacy like Twitter, from a perceptional standpoint at least. Is Snapchat there yet? Instagram, how much time are you guys spending on these? I'd love to just paint that picture for us, so if I'm at a team or a league or a network, I know where I should be putting my few social media dollars.
I think that it's probably right. You know, Twitter still owns the real-time space. I think Facebook's actually much more of a real-time platform that's probably given credit for. We certainly see that from video consumption. Still, there is the first and huge, enormous spike on Facebook in terms of video consumption still happens in the first 15 to 20 minutes. Okay. So it's still pretty fast, and then will grow for a period of time and then drop off. But the life cycle of a piece of social video content is 48 hours. So when people are thinking about, you know, this piece of content I'm creating, what does it mean? We tell them, imagine it's disappeared from existence in 48 hours' time, and that's the way you should think about the content you're creating, because it doesn't have a lifespan in these environments, which is very long. I think that Snapchat is growing pretty fast, obviously owns a very specific demographic, has a, you know, completely different model. They offer new challenges to write sort of things such as vertical video and telling stories in a different way. Same challenge for advertisers too, that they're pushing out a very different platform, but it's a very mobile optimized platform, and I'm fascinated by where they get to with this, you know, with curation. They're in a place where they're curating the content rather than letting, you know, the algorithms and the influences of its consumers discover that content. I think that, you know, what we've seen, that Instagram has been growing really fast. There's been, you know, a huge amount of interest in it, particularly driven by, you know, by celebrities and clubs and brands. It's still quite a closed platform. It's frustrating to us as a sort of provider of video platform services that we can't integrate into Instagram, not very easily. There's some workarounds that you can use, but it's certainly growing very quickly, and we're seeing, from our perspective, the fact that you can now support vertical and square video, horizontal video on the platform is really interesting. But the others, you know, we're talking a lot about, you know, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, but we should think about Line, we should think about Kakao, we should think about WeChat, you know, we should think about QQ in China. There's an enormous number of other consumers who are also interested in the content for many of the people who are sitting around this room today who don't necessarily spend their time on traditional platforms, and those are in the hundreds of millions, if not billions, of consumers. And certainly for us, you know, the challenge is how we make that work, you know, really effectively for clients. But it's, I think we sometimes can become very, very focused on sort of understood, you know, Western environments and services, and forgetting that there's actually another 2 billion consumers out there in other markets which are just as interested in football and our content.
Right. Andy, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's no kind of right or wrong answer. There's no sort of set template. It's kind of, this is what you should do. It depends on the audience that you're trying to reach, ultimately the assets that you have, whether you have video rights or you don't have video rights. It ultimately comes back to having the right digital strategy that should tie into your overall business objectives, and you kind of go from there. But, you know, Twitter, obviously, I think it's done a great job with kind of integrating into broadcast, into kind of, you know, I think they're sort of very innovative in terms of kind of big events. Rugby World Cup, we'll see a lot of a lot of new innovation. You know, Wimbledon, had great success on Twitter, but some of our clients, you know, the audience they're trying to reach and what they're trying to do, Twitter isn't as important. But Facebook, like you say, has the reach. You'd be mad to ignore Facebook, you know, although not great in China.
I think you made a good point about resources too. That is a real challenge that we see for a lot of our customers, you know, from even some of the biggest clubs, the biggest broadcasters, actually having the people with the skills to be able to create all of this content. When there's, you asked about challenges earlier, one of the things I was going to say is at the moment the direct monetization return is still quite unproven on these platforms, which is, you know, part of the the story that we're saying to our clients is that you need to be creating social video, you need to distribute social video because there is a huge return, there's a huge opportunity, but that's still unproven at this point. These markets are too immature to sit there and say that there are great case studies of X million dollars being provided to broadcasters and rights in this market. So part of it is about, for us, it's about you looking at the trends. You just look at trends in behavior and saying, if we look at how consumers spend their time, what platforms they spend their time on, what those trends look like, then following those trends is where the value is going to be in the next 3 to 5 years. And you know, you look at mobile and you look at mobile video in particular, that you know, it's growing at 80 to 150% year on year. It isn't slowing down in any market. Therefore, you project that forward. There has to be some value created. You need to be flexible enough on the journey to make sure you capture it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating, exciting, scary time. You guys have done a great job painting a picture of what it is and how to deal with it on a day-to-day basis. So thanks very much for joining us today. Appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for coming.